Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the children of Christopher Reeve chat to me about the incredible new documentary about their father's life, Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. I also talk to the great Enda Walsh and director Tim Millions about bringing Claire Keegan's novel Small Things Like These to the big screen, the much talked about and wonderful new Irish movie. We'll also be catching up at what's going on at this year's International Cork Film Festival, now entering 69th year indeed. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. If you want to get in touch with me, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you the show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well and you enjoyed Halloween, and if you've children in your life, if they trick-or-treated well and all that went well and there's oodles of sugar rushing through their bloodstream in your house. Of course, the scariest thing this week was, in terms of people knocking on the door, was politicians. Hasn't even been an election called yet, and I had my first political caller. So, let's talk TV. And this week I was watching this.
As therapist, I think we're all on a hot streak.
Whoa, you wear your sex boxes at work for you, little freak.
Dress for the job you want.
Wow, you better slow that down.
This is why I hate to come out of my office.
I think that Alice is worried about me.
It's rough to realize your kid knows how fragile you are.
Paul, do not do that. Yeah. Now he's so strong.
I'm not fragile.
Why don't you try and stick to conventional therapy? Try and be normal.
You're not going to start jimmying me?
Start jimmying you?
You know, that weird therapy you do outside of the office that Paul hates.
Jimmying, though, huh?
Dear God.
I like that.
And that's our time.
It's just that it sounds like a movement.
Now, that was a clip from Shrinking on Apple TV. We mentioned this a while ago when season one came out, where Jason Segel plays a therapist who's suffered huge personal loss with the death of his wife, and he's a therapist, and he decides, because of the dark place he's in his own life, he's going to be a different kind of therapist and just tell them what they need to hear, his various patients, as opposed to actually, you know, following proper therapeutic practice. And it has decent results at times. Season one was great. Season two has returned a couple of weeks ago on Apple TV. It's dropping weekly. And it is as good as season one. We have Harrison Ford playing his boss. We also have a couple of his patients, his daughter. We also have a co-worker, Gabby, played by the great Jessica Williams, who they may have a frisson, let's put it that way. And he's continuing to work with his patients. One of his patients is now living with him from the first season. But what's happening in it is, like all great sitcoms, the initial premise of the show, this idea that he would be unorthodox with his patients, is kind of going into the background a bit, and it's just becoming about the lives of the various characters in the show. So it's en route to being a pretty great sitcom, I think. So Shrinking season two, I think it's four episodes in, is as good as season one, and a great watch. And even though it's about heavy kind of topics, as in death and therapy and love and all the messiness of life, there's something kind of gentle about it as well. And I'm not sure why that is. Maybe I should think harder to tell you why that is and earn my money. But I haven't come to a proper conclusion. But it's entertaining and pleasant TV despite the heavy subject matter. That's Shrinking on Apple TV. Season two has started. Only Murders in the Building also ended this week. I'm a big fan of that show on Disney Plus. It's well set up for season five. Now, they may be in slight danger of, you know, going to the well too much and jumping the shark and over-egging and all those other cliches, but it's damn fine TV. Here's something I'll tell you about TV this week that I came across, and this might amuse you. Well, I don't know. Not amuse you, but I'd like your views on it. So I have to watch a lot of stuff. Movies, TV, all that kind of thing. So I don't have a lot of idle hours to watch stuff. But I think it was Bank Holiday Monday or the day after. I was on the couch with my good lady wife. And I was between shows, let's say, and things I had to watch. And This Is Us is now on Disney Plus, or may have been for a long time, which is a show from a good while ago at this stage that's all about three siblings and their interconnected lives and their parents and their adoptive parents. And it's gotten great reviews over the years. It's now finished, as far as I know. And I've interviewed people who've been in it, not about that, but it has in it Sterling K. Brown, who to my mind is one of the greatest living actors, brilliant, brilliant actor from American Fiction and the O.J. Simpson, The People versus O.J. Simpson, brilliant, brilliant actor. Anyway, so I started watching this with my wife and got about four or five in and thought, this is great, I'm really enjoying this. I'm just going to check now how much is left on it. And there is 18 episodes in season one, and there are five more seasons. So that is 18 episodes per season of six seasons. And I just thought, I can't do this. I can't commit. And maybe I should, but 18 episodes, it's kind of soap opera territory in a way. And they're long episodes. They're not short. So I've kind of given up on This Is Us, not because it's not great, but because I just don't have the time. Do let me know your commitment or commitment phobia to certain TV shows. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that we would be talking to Enda Walsh about small things like these, which may interest you to know received its world premiere at the Berlin Film Festival. Talking of film festivals, next week, the 7th of November, we'll see the 69th year of the Cork International Film Festival. There are a lot of things on you'll want to see. I'm delighted to be joined now by Festival Director and CEO Fiona Clark. Hi Fiona, how are you?
Hi, good thanks John, how are you?
Good. So listen, you know, for the uninitiated, film festivals, we hear about them, you know, Venice, Toronto, even Cork, of course, and Berlin, as I mentioned there. But why do they matter?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those other festivals, because I think it's worth just remembering that Cork International Film Festival was established right at the beginning with some of those really big film festivals, Cannes, Venice, Berlin. And there were, at the time in the 50s, there were just about five of them. And the Conference of Film Festivals picked Cork as being an important place for a film festival. Mm. And it was a really big deal for Ireland. I mean, this was before Cork even had an airport. So it was a very significant cultural event to be happening in Ireland and really connecting Ireland with mainland Europe. And, you know, we've just kind of gone from strength to strength since then. And film festivals are these sort of amazing kind of beasts with their own life. You know, it's very different from when you just choose to go to the cinema on a Thursday night for a film. Here you have over 11 days, 200 plus films and events that have all been really carefully selected. You know, we were in Berlin back in February for the opening night of the festival where small things like these play. So we've been tracking these films all year. And the program is really thoughtful. You know, there's something for everybody, whether it's a family or you're interested in the environment, or you just want a really spooky or fun night out, or some really serious documentaries about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, so give us some of the highlights then, because I know Conclave is one, the Edna O'Brien story as well, an interesting documentary.
Yeah, so Conclave, really thrilled to be opening the festival with this. It's a fantastic film. Obviously, people will know the book, the Robert Harris book, but the film, it's so sumptuous. It's brilliant acting, Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci, amongst others. And not only is it a really good story, you know, it's kind of political drama, it looks gorgeous. And it's going to be an amazing viewing experience because we're screening that in the Everyman Palace Theatre. Now, that originally was a cinema back in the day. It's where the festival started, but it's a Victorian theatre. And
beautiful place to see anything.
Absolutely beautiful. But we go to a lot of efforts to recreate a full cinema experience with 4K and surround sound and things. So when you're watching that film, which is so beautiful and sumptuous, the cinematography is extraordinary. You're going to be doing it in these really beautiful surroundings. It's going to feel like such a special occasion. You mentioned the Edna O'Brien. I mean, it's a lovely documentary, very, very topical. But there's, I'd say one of my, you know, one of my top picks for the festival would be another documentary called The Making of a Japanese. It's actually our documentary gala. And it's a gorgeous, really charming kind of observational drama that follows Japanese school kids through their school term and, you know, how their education and their education to be good Japanese citizens as well as their learning. And it's just so charming and a real sort of eye-opener and a very different kind of cultural environment to what we know in Ireland. So it's a real treat, that film.
Yeah. And tell me this then. I saw some interesting older movies like Donnie Darko, for instance, Irreversible by Caspar Noé, a very controversial movie at its time and still is. So you're doing a kind of back in time section.
Yep, there's a retrospective of
retrospective is a better word than back in time.
Well, it sort of it gives us a good excuse to you know, these aren't just films that we really like, but they're thoughtfully curated again around the sort of concept of time. So we kind of refer to these films as sort of the superpowers, you know, they're bending time and gives us, you know, it's a great opportunity to revisit these films. You wouldn't get to see them on the big screen normally, so you know, a real treat. And as you said, there's a lovely mixture there. But I'd also maybe draw attention to another strand, a new strand for this year called Disruptors. And this is really interesting because it's a combination of classic films, four classic films and four brand new premieres. But all of them are connected by a sense of being maverick and rebellious filmmakers who pushed boundaries, both in terms of the subject matter and the form. And there's, you know, there's a lovely mixture there. So we've got With Nail and I, which is a big favorite.
And you know, Bruce Robinson is attending.
He is. Bruce Robinson's attending, and he's going to be receiving the inaugural Disruptors Honorary Award, which will be presented to him by Paul McGann, who obviously stars in the film. Yeah. So that's going to be a really wonderful kind of celebratory occasion. And then you've got alongside that, you know, the other film, Serial Mom and My Own Private Idaho, but brand new films like Photogenico, and which is has the most amazing kind of French techno soundtrack. Then we're doing a like nice after party with the musicians afterwards in the festival club. So that'll be a really good night out.
Yeah. Well, look, it all sounds like great stuff for any film enthusiast or even the casual viewer. So the most important stuff, it's running from the 7th of November to the 17th of November. Where can people get tickets?
Really easy. Just go to the website corkfilmfest.org. Or you can download our app, which is myciff.org. Couldn't be easier. Everything can be booked online.
Indeed.
And we have some great ticket bundles as well. So you get great discounts if you book some 3 or 5 tickets, etc.
Fantastic. Well, look, I wish you every success entering its now staggering 69th year. That is Fiona Clark, Festival Director and CEO of the Cork International Film Festival in rude health. Thank you, Fiona.
Thanks, Mill.
After the break, Christopher Reeve's children on the remarkable story of their father's life. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and movie show. I do hope you're well. Now take a listen to this.
It's Memorial Day weekend, 1995. My dad was competing in a cross-country horseback riding competition.
And was just so excited to get down there.
And my dad had been in London for some reason a few weeks before. We said goodbye and I ran upstairs to watch him, you know, walk away. And I remember him turning, I guess instinctively, knowing I would do that. And he gave this wave. That was the last time I saw him on his feet.
Yes, now that is a clip from the new film documentary that's opening this weekend, the 1st of November, in cinemas across the nation, called Superman, the Christopher Reeve Story. And it is obviously about Christopher Reeve and his remarkable life from being Superman and how he, you know, starred in those four movies and invented modern superheroism and all that. And it's also about his own life prior to his well-reported accident, with some real insights into his father, who was a strange man, this very serious academic who really left him somewhat emotionally bereft, it has to be said. And then, of course, we get to him becoming paralyzed from the neck down after a horse riding accident with spinal cord injuries, and then becoming a disability rights activist and getting back in to making films. And it also looks at, what a great father he wasn't at times and what a great father he was. It has some beautiful and very sad moments in it as well. There's a beautiful eulogy we get to see by Robin Williams. He and Robin Williams were very, very close. We get to see his children, most importantly, talking. And this is the first time there's been full family cooperation. Will, Matthew and Alexandra, his two children, and his three children, his two sons and one daughter. Now, one of them has a different mother. You might think, why am I saying that? It is kind of relative to what happened, because Dana Reeve, who is Will's mother, passed away, as you may know as well. It is a fascinating documentary that really, I said yes to interviewing all these people because Superman just fired my imagination in 1982 and I was fascinated by Christopher Reeve. This is a beautiful documentary that had me, I'm not ashamed to say it, crying in the cinema, as did it have the other two people who were there with me, as far as I could hear from the darkness. So I got to talk to Christopher Reeve's three children, Will Reeve, Matthew Reeve and Alexandra Reeve, earlier in the week, and we spoke about the documentary. Guys, lovely to see you. The film's powerful. It really is. I was in a cinema with two other men and myself included. There was a lot of weeping, and I mean that as a compliment. And I see a lot of movies for this gig. Alexandra, just on that, I mean, you're doing the press now and there's going to be people like me asking you questions like this. So you're back in it again. And I wonder, do you have any reservations about opening up some of this again, which some of it was very joyful, but some of it, the story of your dad's life is very sad. Is it tough in any way to be back talking about all this?
You know, really, it's been incredibly powerful to share this story, put it out in the world, and then suddenly see how people are connecting to it and how they're reacting from their own experiences they've had in their own lives. We often think about the fact that our circumstances were quite unique because of our dad's fame and the severity of the accident that he had. But there are so many themes in here that people are experiencing in their own life, whether it's navigating a divorce or a friend who goes through an illness, or, you know, what it is to really be a life partner with someone through thick and thin and have your relationship change and grow over time. And so, yes, some of that involves putting our own story out there and being more vulnerable than I would say I am in my day job. But we're getting it regifted to us tenfold because we're seeing these people connect in just a very humbling but really beautiful way at the same time.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it. I was talking to Peter and Ian, and I use this quote all the time from Tolstoy, who says every family is tragic in its own unique way, you know, and I think that's really true. So maybe, you know, no matter who your mother or father is, there's a story to be told. Matthew, one of the things I really like about it is that, you know, your dad was Superman. Lots of people think their father is Superman, or some people do anyway, but they're not. But yours was actually playing Superman. And yet you're very honest about, at times, he was far from Superman as a dad, you know. And there's a great line that stuck in my head, that your mother at times was almost a single mother in the early days. So I guess in a similar way to what I asked Alexandra, did you have any reservations about being so candid about your dad's parenting at times? I'm awfully glad you were, but did you have any, have I gone too far on this?
Well, maybe now that you mention it. No, I didn't. I mean, we always agreed when decided to embark on this journey that we would be honest. We would give ourselves to these interviews and share things we'd never shared before. And it was, you know, yeah, I think it was just something that we, in the same way he was always very honest in interviews from the time when he was promoting Superman and talking about experiencing fame or sort of having a less than awesome experience with a certain co-star, or after the accident, he would talk about, you know, his injury and his experiences sort of nearly dying. And so it was, there was never really, there weren't reservations. I mean, we committed to this fully when we agreed to do it. And also, I think at the same time, my dad was an incredible dad. I mean, he was just very busy and he traveled a lot, but we always felt incredibly loved and supported. And I think that shows through in the film as they made it.
And I'd like to add that our candor and vulnerability was not done with the intention of showing everything that, like, our goal was not, hey, let's show some things wrong with Christopher Reeve. On the contrary, it was, hey, let's paint a human portrait of a deeply human man and all the complexities that entails, because that enhances his story ultimately and proves even further why he was such a hero, not just to the world, but to us as a father. We didn't care that he was Superman. Yeah. We didn't care that he was famous. We didn't even care that he was in a wheelchair, because he was just dad. And he was a phenomenal father. And it was an honor to be a part of his life. And hopefully we brought a little joy to his.
Absolutely. I'm sure you did. I've no doubt. And Will, I was just about to come to you, but you brought yourself in. But my next question
I have that
was
knack,
for you. You have that knack. And it's funny, my eldest son is called Will as well. So I had a double interest in talking to you, because there's a lot of names. But I'm wondering, just that moment when you realized your dad was in a wheelchair and was probably going to be, certainly for a long time, if not the rest of his life. Do you have memories of that moment of
this? I was so young. I don't really recall. I don't think I had the capability of recognizing anything. To me, it was just life. I didn't give it much thought. I don't ever recall bemoaning the fate that had befallen me as a young kid. I never found it unfair or unjust that my friends had dads who were walking around playing catch with them while mine couldn't, because my dad was everything that one would hope for in a father. He was present, he was emotionally available, he was encouraging, supportive, loving, fun, fair. And that's all that ultimately mattered to me. The fact that he couldn't walk around the house or drive me to school by himself. Do I wish that he could have? Of course, for him is just as much for me. But I don't feel cheated out of any experience. And I certainly don't recall the moment that he was injured just because I was so young.
Yeah. And Will, just before I let you go there, you know, there were so many moments in it. And I told the guys, Peter and Ian, that the Robin Williams eulogy is just, oh my God, it's overpowering. And the fact that we're able to see that. But one moment that really stuck with me, and maybe it's because you're my son's namesake, is you talk about, I'm alone now after your mother died, and no matter who's in my life, I'm alone. And that really struck me. But I'm sure that was recorded a while ago. And I'm wondering now today, do you still feel that way?
Well, to clarify, what I mean by that is that I've been alone in the sense that I've had a void without my parents. There's been a hole in my life since they've been gone, as there would be for anyone. But we mend in the broken places. And I've been able for 20 years now to use my grief for good and to find some measure of healing from it. And that is ultimately the place that I want to get to. I've never actually felt that I've had to navigate life alone. I have these two wonderful role models and my siblings. I have so many support systems, from my family to friends to my girlfriend to colleagues to, I have a massive village of concentric circles around me holding me up. So I've never actually been alone. What I mean by alone is without the two ultimates in my life. And there is a distinction there that would have taken longer to explain in the documentary, so you can see why they cut it out. But
don't fret for
me, my friend. I am okay, and I will be okay.
Yeah, no, well, you all seem very well. Our time is up. I just want to tell you, you know, as a 8-year-old in Dublin, Ireland in 1982, watching Superman 2 and seeing your dad fly up, it's just one of the defining, not even cinematic memories of my life, memories of my life. So it's just a delight to talk to the three of you, and the film's fantastic. And it's nice to see you so seemingly happy and together. So a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Will Reeve, Matthew Reeve and Alexandra Reeve there, talking to me about the remarkable new documentary, Superman, the Christopher Reeve story, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 1st of November. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Now, Superman, the Christopher Reeve story, was directed by two gentlemen called Ian Bonhot and Peter Ettigue, who previously gave us the great documentary McQueen. And I spoke to the two of them about bringing the story of Christopher Reeve's life to the big screen.
Guys, the film's fantastic. You know, I got an email about 4 weeks ago and I barely read it. And I just said yes to the interviews that were happening because I was 8 years old in a cinema in Dublin. I remember being with my aunt, my mother and my brother watching Superman 2 and seeing him fly for the first time and literally the whole cinema kind of going, oh, my God. And it's one of those, maybe I'm oversharing, but it's one of those like things that fired my cinematic imagination. And that's a very long way of me saying to you, like in terms of you guys getting involved in this, was a part of it how beloved the Superman character is and was?
Yeah, I think this, you know, you... How often as a documentary maker you get given the doors to such an iconic cultural, you know, cultural icon. So that's the main thing. And I think, you know, there's an irony in the tragedy of the, you know, the accident from the Man of Steel ending up, you know, the man in a chair without being able to move. And I think that scope of the how the table have turned, was sort of, you know, very, very tragic and very moving. And that just compelled us to want to know more about it and just bring it to the world.
And Peter, the access you get is incredible. And these home movies that, you know, are just, it's hard to believe you're watching them, that there's Christopher Reeve at home with his family. Did the family get on board and say, here's this stuff, maybe you want to see this? Or was it just a case of you knew it was out there?
No, the whole film came out of an archive discussion. There's a wonderful archive producer, Daniel Kilroy, who got in touch via LinkedIn with Matthew Reeve and said, you guys, have you got any sort of like family archive that you might be willing? And that approach from Daniel coincided with the Reeves, for the first time, feeling open to the idea that it was a good time to make the film. And you know, where they were in their lives, the fact that their father's, the anniversary of their father's death was almost 20 years away, all those things sort of like conspired to sort of like make them open to the idea. We then came on board subsequently to that and we obviously what we had to do is then sort of like come up with a way of approaching this story and how would we use all of this archive and how would we use the kids as interviewees and all of that. And luckily the kids had seen our films, so that made things a lot easier. And then we had a series of Zoom discussions and met in person. Fairly quickly won their trust and agreed that, you know, they had very little influence over the film itself, but they obviously wanted to feel they could trust us as filmmakers to do justice to their father's legacy.
They've got very busy life, do you see what I mean? So many people ask us, you know, they would have wanted to keep an eye on the film, but thinking back, they've got kids, they've got very successful career, their life is not being the offspring of Christopher Reeve.
Exactly.
They're very good at saying that actually they love what their father stood for, but they don't love him for being Superman. They love him because he's their dad.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that comes across in the film. And, you know, either of you can answer this, but what I liked about it was, you know, he's Superman, and to use an almost tabloid cliche, he's not a super dad at times. And Matthew at one point says, you know, my mother was kind of a single parent in the early years. And it's very honest and it's refreshing. And you know, no family is perfect. We all know that. By virtue of being alive, we know that. But whose idea was it to go so raw about what kind of dad he'd been? Like, did you have to push the children to be honest about that, or did they come to you with that stuff?
I think they were old enough to have digested some of the issues with their parents. And I think post-accident, and you see it in the film, they rekindled, and Chris improved as a man and as a father. He says it himself in the film, you know, he needed to break his back to realize some of the things.
His neck.
And I think that's the thing that really makes him compelling as a person is that he did a few things. He did, you know, as you said, no one is perfect, but he worked at improving himself. He worked at keeping the relationship with his kid. He was very much helped by Dana, you know, his second partner. But at the same time, you know, the first partner, gay extended mother of Matt and Al, had to accept this new sort of family dynamic, and they grew closer as well as a family. So I think there's a beautiful message about reconstituted families, and you know, so many of us come from broken marriages or people move on. You know, there's nothing perfect out in this world, but the family really, they don't think they're perfect. They don't think the world need perfection. There's more scope in creating something emotionally charged and almost heroic if you're not meant to be, you know, given everything easily and be perfect.
There was an agreement between us all that we were not going to be making a celebrity puff piece. I think they would have walked away, or we would have walked away, had that been the case, and that nothing was going to be off limits in terms of where we went in the interview.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you know, I always quote Tolstoy, every family is tragic in its own unique way. And it's even Superman's family had tragedy in it as well. One of the things I loved about it was I had seen pictures of Christopher Reeve and Robin Williams together before, but I didn't realize just how close they were. And it's so beautiful. And that there's very sad moments in it, but the one, and I could even spill over here, so I have to be careful, but the one that really got me in the cinema last week was where he's giving the eulogy. My goodness, was that footage freely available to you? Because I didn't know that existed.
Yeah, that was one of the extraordinary
tapes,
tapes that was, I don't know who actually, I can't remember who made that tape, but basically is of the memorial service. And
it's their cameras. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so it was the family camera that was being used to to film everything. And it's an extraordinary service. I mean, you know, Robin is not by any means the only person who breaks down and is raw and emotional in it. So, you know, yeah, it was extraordinary. And it was wonderful to have that because, you know, obviously Robin isn't here to sit for an interview. So to be able to have him in the archive throughout the film and then have that moment where he breaks down as he bids Christopher farewell was just unique and devastating, I think. You know, I think you're agreeing with me. I that moment gets me every time I see it, and I've seen it like, I don't know, thousands of times.
More than me. Tell me this, based on this and McQueen, which I really enjoyed as well, I'm fans of what you do. So I'm wondering, I know you're in the middle of this and it's all Superman, but I'd love to know what your next project is.
So would we.
we actually, at the moment, we took a while between, I mean, Rising Phoenix, which is the film we did between McQueen and Superman, came a little bit quicker. But we took a while before actually boarding another project. Rising Phoenix came out in August 2020 in the height of COVID. But, you know, it's October 2024 now, so it's more than 4 years. 2 years to make it, but 2 years of hesitation. You don't come across great stories all the time and great people. And, you know, you're talking about the archive, you're talking about the family, you're talking about completely everyone on this project from our team to their side pull in the same direction. We all had the same vision to do justice, but not to whitewash anything. And I think if you have that energy and you have all this access we had, then the films can be great. And you need people with such great stories. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. We wouldn't just embark on any other films to make another documentary. There are a few things bubbling about, but great stories take time.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, you've made a great story in this one. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, the directors there, Ian and Peter, talking to me about making, directing Christopher Reeve, the Superman story. A fantastic watch. Up next, Enda Walsh on bringing small things like these to the screen. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, the big new Irish release of the week is the beautiful and brilliant new movie based on the novel by Clare Keegan called Small Things Like These.
Aren't they fed and kept warm and given a trade? Sure, if it wasn't for the nuns, those girls would have known.
Don't I know that?
So what do we have to answer for?
Don't you ever question it?
If you want to get on in this life, there are things you have to ignore. You've always been soft.
Yeah, so that is a clip from the much and rightly talked about Small Things Like These. We have 1980s New Ross, County Wexford. The brilliant Cillian Murphy, Oscar winner, plays Bill Furlong, who's a coal man, and it's a grimy job he has, lifting sacks of coal. Reminds me of our own coal men when we were children in Northside Dublin. And it's in the run-up to Christmas. He has five daughters, I believe it is, married to Eileen Walsh, and he's a hard-working man who has maybe some scars from the past that are loosely intimated at. And he's delivering coal to what we realise is now a Magdalene laundry. And he comes across some disturbing scenes and he wrestles with the idea of doing something about it. And it's a brilliantly wrought story about Bill Furlong, Cillian Murphy's character, wrestling with that idea and maybe doing something about it, and the weight of church opposition and community opposition to calling out anything that would be negative against the church, as you kind of heard there from the clip. It is a great watch. It's a slow, haunting kind of film. And Cillian Murphy, could it be 2 years in a row for an Oscar? Possibly. I wouldn't have any argument so far, I have to say. Eileen Walsh is brilliant in it as well. Emily Watson plays the kind of mother superior in this Magdalene laundry. And she's icily brilliant in it. She really is. Now, it was adapted from Claire Keegan's novel. It was directed by the Belgian director, Tim Millence, who I know from the brilliant BBC show The Responder, where Martin Friedman plays this kind of somewhat crooked cop. It's a brilliant, brilliant show on BBC. And it was adapted for the screen by the brilliant Enda Walsh, who gave us Disco Pigs. He's written so many brilliant plays, Ballyturk. He's screenwritten lots of stuff, along with Steve McQueen, Hunger. Brilliant guy. He also had a role as an Irish wolfhound back in the 90s, which we may or may not get to. But here is my chat from earlier in the week with director Tim Millence and the great Enda Walsh. Tim, if I can start with you, I was a child of the 80s and we had a coal man, I remember it, and he was filthy. He was really grimy. And what I like about the movie, and it might be a strange place to start, is that Cillian's character and the business he's in, it's really grimy, just on a physical level, whatever about any kind of emotional metaphor. It seems to me you went out of your way to make it look really coaly and dirty and like hard labour. But you tell me.
Thank you so much. I think making the sack coal really heavy, like make it really hard on Cillian all the time, that really helped. We just make it difficult for Cillian. That was the way in.
Enda, you're a similar age to me, and you know, there's a part of me when I hear about Magdalene laundries and all that kind of stuff that I'm like, oh God, you know, because it's such a grim chapter in our past. I wonder, when you get the call to be involved in this, does a part of you think that as well, or are you just looking for a great story always?
I know what you mean, but I mean, it's sort of like an... I know what you mean by that, and that probably was, for a half a second, that was my sort of sense of it too, of like, oh God, do I need to go there? But the thing it was is that I never really went there before. It was sort of, it's in our consciousness and it's in our sort of history and we're aware of it, but I turn it off without actually sort of looking at it. Do you know what I mean? And really sort of like, you know, thinking about it and feeling it out. And when I read the book, that book sort of like, I think, got the atmosphere and the culture of sort of small town Ireland, maybe all of Ireland, really, really well, of how we sort of quietly police one another, you know, through sort of like gossip, I guess, and that type of thing. And I thought, oh, that's really sort of fascinating. And so really I loved the book in terms of sort of its minimalism, how it sort of tells the story, how, you know, this, but also I also wanted to do it because I actually wanted to sort of sit with the subject matter and actually sort of study it and learn it and feel it out in that way. So, yeah, I thought that was very, very important for me to do as an Irish person, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I should say I was playing devil's advocate somewhat, because it's a terrific story, very well told. And as I say, I really enjoyed it. But I suppose you and I have lived through that. So I suppose I'm sure. Curious on that. Tim, just going back to you, I mean, in relationship to what me and Enda were saying there about, you know, there's a collective, oh my God, this dark Irish past. You're Belgium, or Belgian, I should say, not to confuse adjectives and noun. Mm-hmm. But so was it, I don't know, difficult for you to find your way into this? Or is it that, you know, this is a story about human trauma and that's universal, whether it's Belgian, Irish, Catholic, Jehovah's Witness or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. As you said, like, I think I lost my brother when I was very young, and that's actually the trauma of my life. So actually, in whatever I do, whatever I make, grief is at the center of it, because I recognize that pain. And it became, I think that's also the engine of the story. It's like how to cope with grief, or even how not to cope with grief, because that's what's happening with Bill Furlong. I think everybody told me about Ireland in the 50s. It's like men were not allowed to talk about their emotions or to talk about their grief and their pain. And I think that really resonated with me. There's like, he built like an iron wall in front of him, and there's like a volcano starting to burst out. And he used that pain to turn it into something better. And that's a story I understand. As far as, of course, I'm really honest. I don't know much about Ireland or the history about Ireland. There are similarities, however, with Flanders. I think education is religious, healthcare is religious. The Catholic Roman Church has always been the moral compass in our society. So there are similarities, but I couldn't say I fully got it or understand it. There are people for me to help me.
Sure, sure. And one thing I was struck about when I was watching it was, you know, as I keep referring to, we live through this stuff, but I suppose I had a different education thing, and for reasons I won't bore you with. So I never had a sense of how tied up the church was with the education system. But what the film lays bare is that, you know, you step out against the church, that's all well and good, but you're probably screwing up your children's education. And I mean, if you have four or five kids, as Mr. Furlong does in this, you're really shooting them in the foot. Were you struck by that in Claire's novel, and then when you went to write about it? I mean, maybe you weren't, but that's something that kind of struck me about it.
Yeah, and I love in the novel and in the film, the girls' school is right beside the mother and baby home, the laundry, like right beside it. It's sort of like it's separated by a wall, and I thought that, you know, just the idea of those being a young girl and knowing, you know, that the church are saying that's where all the bad people go. You got to watch yourself. This is sort of, they're laying down their sort of their moral sort of like principles, and, you know, like, and, you know, to everyone. And in doing so, we're sort of like creating sort of this hierarchy, this moral sort of like hierarchy, you know, in our society. There's like those huge, you know, and on the back, you know, like they would sort of, at the time, they would say it was the sort of the last refuge for these girls. These girls were sort of thrown out by their families. They were, you know, abandoned by the fathers of their, you know, like these babies. And that's true. But they were like a cruel refuge, like a really, and at times really sort of abusive. And not only that, you know, they're sort of like they're places of business. That the government actually sort of gave the responsibility to the church just to handle these problematic people. It's sort of, all of that is just so massive and huge. And yet, you know, like I think about today, you know, when I think about the sort of story and what he does and what Bill does and sort of like in his own quiet way sort of calls it out and says it's wrong, isn't it? You know, like that, yeah, you're right. There's a feeling or sort of definitely more than a notion that this man potentially is going to completely detonate his own life, his business, his girl's future by doing that. And it's all of that's from a storytelling point of view just feels really, really incredibly strong and brutal. And I think it's sort of, and in fairness, what we've done, I think, in Ireland is that we've looked at that history. You know, this year compensation has been sort of given out to these women.
Yeah.
You know, we've looked at it and it's important to sort of, you know, to try and figure out, you know, why we did what we sort of did, whether it wasn't sort of particularly sort of Irish, but it was the sort of, you know, not the worst of humanity, but it was like, do you know what I mean? It was a terrible sort of like, you know, way of behaving to a small population of, you know, like living in our country to our neighbors or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And I should say, you know, you talk about his resistance. There's a lot of hope in it and quiet heroism as well, just for people listening to get a sense of that as well. Tim, can I just ask you briefly, I haven't seen that much of what you've done, but I did adore The Responder. And Martin Freeman in that, you know, people talk about edgy lead characters, but I'm not sure if I've ever seen on TV a cop or any character as edgy and twitchy and fraught. And I'm just wondering, you know, does he just bring all that to the set with you, or did that take a long time for you and him to get in the zone on that?
Yeah, exactly. I think that my secret is like I tell them all my problems, I share it with them, and it's in their heads and can't get out anymore. So they're stuck with it, with all my horrible pasts and ideas and images. But no, if you're talking about, traumatic men who are vulnerable, who can't cope with their emotions, I'm the guy. You have to call me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to bear that in mind. Yeah. And in closing then, can I just ask you, like, I have one of our great screenwriters and playwrights, and you're probably going to hit me for asking this because I'm going to talk to you for 30 seconds about playing a dog once, but my colleagues, former colleagues on RTE outed you as the person who was in the wolfhound costume all those years in 1990 Italian football.
I outed myself.
You did. Myself, you did. Actually. Fair play to you. But what I was wondering was, like, do you think there might be a documentary or something in that? Because it seems so incongruous that, you know, the guy who gave us Ballyturk and Hunger and stuff like that was actually dressed as a giant Irish wolfhound running around as Jack Charlton, you know, created a revolution in Irish soccer. Do you think you might go somewhere at that in the future from a dramatic point of view?
When my wife found out about it, she thought it was just sort of like I put it out there as a joke and it sort of got out of control. And I went, no, this was the best time of my life. And I would love that. It's hilarious. I mean, so many people get in touch with me about it now. They're just like, and they go, honestly, is this still, it's sort of, no, but it's completely sort of true. It's very funny. Very funny. Yeah. Yes.
Well, look,
there should be a documentary about it. I'm up for it.
And listen, Tim does Vulnerable Men. So, you know, he could branch out to Vulnerable Men in wolfhound costumes, I'm sure. It's not that much of a leap. So, you know.
There was nothing vulnerable about that dog. How dare you?
What a terrible place to end. The film is fantastic.
A terrible place. You're going to have to edit that out. All right. Well.
That's gold. I'm winning awards for that. Thank you, guys.
Bye, thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Enda Walsh there. Discussing playing McCool, the Irish wolfhound dog, as part of the FAI mascot back in the 90s. But ostensibly, he was talking to me about the wonderful new movie, Small Things Like These, along with its director, Tim Millance. A great watch, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 1st of November. A fantastic watch. So that's two big recommendations for you this week, folks, in terms of the cinema. Superman, the Christopher Reeve story, and Small Things Like These. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the cast of Paddington, as things stand. which will include people like Olivia Colman, Hugh Bonneville, and Antonio Banderas. So the stars keep on coming, if I may be so bold as to suggest. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy the remainder of this weekend, this Halloween weekend, if it's correct to call it that. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you all next week.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.